George Buck's dead. Last word he said, don't you put no shortening in my bread. George Buck is dead. Last word he said, don't you put no shortening in my bread.
This is part three of the radio adaptation of A Great American Tapestry, a five-part audio documentary based on the film of the same name. I'm David Weintraub, the director and producer. This program is a production of the Center for Cultural Preservation, based in Hendersonville, North Carolina, and WNCW Radio. It's based on the film A Great American Tapestry, The Many Strands of Mountain Music, which is currently touring the region and is available on DVD with more information at saveculture.org. The film was made possible in part by Paul and Simone Shoemaker, Carola and Stuart Cohn, the Perry and Rudnick Endowment Fund, Jim and Barbara Neal, Helen Bishop, and Adept Word Management.
Quiet, please. In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Records and radio changed the face of American music tremendously, but it was a double-edged sword. It opened the door for people from all around the country and the world to listen to mountain music. But it also had the effect of homogenizing the distinctive quality of music community traditions. And as a result, it changed how people responded to music. For the first time, more people listened to music than participated in it. The recording industry and radio also put tremendous control over what got recorded and what got played in fewer and fewer hands. The effect was felt on African-American music most of all. We start with Phil Jameson, a professor of Appalachian history at Warren Wilson College, to discuss how the recording age changed the music.
So in the 1920s, once the radio came in, all of a sudden you could have people hearing music from outside their local community. And this was a big deal, but it certainly opened up people's repertoires to hearing different kinds of music. And when you hear those other kinds of music, you hear a song you like on the radio or on a record, you make it part of your own. And that's really when a lot of regional fiddle styles changed. The earliest 78s that were recorded in the 1920s, the ones from North Georgia are totally different than the ones from Kentucky or from Tennessee or from, you know, wherever you want to go, because there were certainly regional styles. But then once everybody started learning everybody else's music, it became more homogenized.
Living in a world today where world music is accessible by a click of a mouse, push of a button, or the command of one's voice, it's difficult to comprehend the impact when the radio and records hit the airwaves. In 1922, WSB in Atlanta was one of the first high-powered radio stations featuring fiddler John Carson, followed by WBAP in Texas, WLS in Chicago, broadcasting the National Barn Dance, and WSM in Nashville. We pick it up with David Holt, Grammy Award-winning musician and music historian.
The records and radio came in about the same time, about 1922, 1923, and that really upended everything. Because here people had been learning, living in their little hollers, playing what their granddaddy played, and maybe something from the county over, that's all they knew. But then when the records and radio came in, it was like, you know, you heard all this other stuff, and it really, people started learning other music, other styles, adding it to theirs, you know, it was a huge influence. And there became stars then, like Roy Acuff and Jimmy Rogers first, I guess would be the first father of country music kind of guy. And there were plenty of guys that were, Uncle Dave Macon, who was a star of the Grand Ole Opry. That really changed things. It really made it there was media involved at that point.
And with the music being a commodity, rather than something you did on the back porch with your friends and family, it transformed not only the music, but the community itself.
What that did was change it and commodify it, turn it into more of something you listen to. Because if you're listening to the radio or a 78 RPM record, it's not something you're doing at a community function. It's something for your entertainment. And that fundamentally changed the style of the music, and the musicians responded, knowing that you don't just play that same fiddle tune over and over and over and over again for entertainment. You have to do something more to it to make it catchier and more attractive through the radio or recordings. This is really what led to the development of bluegrass music from old-time music, because the old-time music is more dance-oriented. It was the music for dances. And bluegrass music became more of a stage show for a consuming audience that sits there and listens.
Southern music came into its own with the onset of radio.
In the 1920s, when the early radio stations were starting up, they were initially thought, it was initially thought that all people wanted to hear was light classical music or opera. And it was sort of a revelation when a few stations started having some rural fiddlers, hillbilly type entertainment on there and realized that this was really popular. And in the 1920s, several stations started up what they called barn dances.
North Carolina, the Stewart Appliance Company presents the Carolina Barn Dance.
And these were not actual dances, these were just radio variety shows that featured country music, fiddlers, banjo players, and singers, and so on. And one of the most influential ones was WLS in Chicago, which had the Chicago Barn Dance. WLS being sponsored by Sears Roebuck, world's largest store. And a number of musicians from the Southern Mountains went to Chicago and performed there, and their music was heard across the country. And so that certainly would get this kind of music spread out. But also in Nashville, the predecessor of the Grand Ole Opry at WSM in Nashville, what became the Grand Ole Opry was the idea of having rural fiddlers, banjo players, string bands play on the radio, and they found it was tremendously popular with rural audiences. So within a few years, there were radio barn dance programs and country music programs all over the country. Here in Asheville, WWNC had a station where Bill Monroe was playing on, you know, in the very, maybe the first year of being bluegrass boys, early days of bluegrass music.
With the coming of the recording industry, the availability of so-called ethnic music was strictly controlled by a handful of companies. Dom Flemons, co-founder of the Carolina Chocolate Drops, picks up the story from here.
The recording industry is a very interesting sort of beast where, just like now in the music business, it's never built on artistic integrity. It's just built on what's going to sell for two people. And so when the recording industry first started, it was ethnic music was the stuff that was selling the best. And what they ended up doing was they were selling ethnic records to the ethnic communities in which would enjoy the music. So we're thinking like right around the end of the First World War, for example. There's a big influx of different immigrants coming into the United States. And so the record companies realized, because they were all based out of New Jersey and New York, they realized that, oh, well, we can sell records to the Italians in the Italian neighborhood in Brooklyn, or we can sell Ukrainian music to the Ukrainian people over in the Lower East Side.
Whether intentional or not, the decisions on what was worthy of recording rested in the hands of record company representatives with little understanding of music history or its value. According to many Appalachian music historians, this had the effect of whitewashing Southern music. Here's more on this from crossover musician Rhiannon Giddens.
And then you have the recording industry coming in and going, all right, so we're going to sell quote-unquote black music to black people and white music. They start, you know, doing this because they want to sell as many records as possible. So they say, okay, black people clearly just listen to blues, neglecting the fact that people can listen to more than one kind of music. And white people clearly listen to hillbilly music. So we got hillbilly music and we got blues music. And so you got a black string band that would walk into a recording studio and the guy's like, so what blues do you know? That back string is going to be like, let me go learn some blues because I want to get paid.
And so slowly but surely, the history of African-American string band music as part of the vibrant American tradition began to disappear. Here's roots musician Justin Robinson.
Remember, record companies were just starting. They were furniture companies before, like, or some of them were. Or, you know, the recording industry was brand new. And so they were just figuring it out. And what they figured out was that this ethnicity thing really worked also. They would have recorded the things that they thought they were going to sell the best to their own community. Not reflective of the musical landscape, just reflective of commerce.
As a result, the blended tradition of music history in the mountains and beyond withered away in the crescendo of music industry profit. But the recording industry was not the only force that filtered out black music from the tradition. The whitewashing of the music was no more evident than in the fiddle conventions and folk festivals, which were an important way of promoting mountain music traditions throughout the Southern Appalachians. By intentionally excluding black musicians from participating, black performers were steadily erased from the history.
The music was became very segregated, partly through the recording industry, but also partly in the 1900s through the folk festivals that started up. And Bascom Lamar Lunsford was trying to promote the music and dances of the Anglo-Saxons who settled here. Well, you know, does he want to see black people up there on the stage? That doesn't really fit with the image that we're trying to sell. And so black folks were not invited to perform at the Mountain Dance and Folk Festival. And what message that sends to the black community is you're not valued in this kind of music. And African-American folks in Western North Carolina today don't realize that it's part of their heritage, too.
You also have, these fiddle conventions coming into being, right? And you have black musicians being banned from playing these conventions. You know, so in the string band community, I mean, that these things become a hub of what's going on musically, and black people are banned. It becomes sort of the ethnic music for white people. You know, it's like, we're going to have this, so let's just kind of take you out. Whether it was conscious or not, that's what happened. You know, the changeover is staggering when you consider, you know, turn of the century, you got half the string bands are black string bands, and then probably 30 years later, it's probably like 5%. You know, I mean, that's staggering to me.
Coming up tomorrow in part 4 of the Great American Tapestry is the Cherokee tradition and its influence on Appalachian music.
George Buck's dead, last word said, don't you put no shortening in my bread. Don't you put no shortening in my bread, now. Don't put no shortening in my bread.
This program was produced for WNCW by Kim Clark.